invite Max to give his Rothschild lecture in this room.
Thank you very much, John, for that great introduction. It's a very deep honor for me to give this lecture, and I've been looking forward to it for quite some time. In trying to decide what to talk about, since the program is geared towards multi-scale modeling, multi-resolution modeling of oceans and atmosphere, I thought I would talk about something else, complementary within climate modeling. People can't hear me, I was told.
Complementary, is another component of climate system modeling is land ice,
in particular
the ice
over Antarctica
and Greenland, which everyone's concerned about because it would melt. I also felt like talking about oceans and atmosphere to the members of this program was like taking coals to Newcastle, although I understand that's not unheard of these days. Okay, I'll just start with some cartoons to show you that this is obviously sea level rise is on the mind of the media, including cartoonists. So I just downloaded a few cartoons showing how it is. So what I'm going to talk about is the science of ice sheets. And the reason I put the science of ice sheets on the title, because this is the sea level rise is extremely politicized, at least in the United States, it's an extremely politicized subject. I'm going to try to talk about what the state of the art of the science of ice sheets is. And here I list my collaborators in this effort. The ones in blue are the ones who are my central collaborators, and without them, there would be no talk. So here's an Earth water distribution figure. Let me just summarize some things. Salt water makes up the huge bulk of the water on Earth. And fresh water is distributed according to that. And so when I say ice sheets have 70%, that's of the fresh water. So if you want to know how much water they actually have, you have to multiply by 2.5%. So they have, and groundwater has 30%. And these numbers don't add up because of round off, I hope. These are the numbers I got off off the web. Surface water makes up very little. Rivers and fresh water. And the atmosphere, although being in England and where I live, it also rains a lot. You would think there's a lot of water in the atmosphere, but there isn't. It's about 10 times the collective water in all biological organisms on Earth. So it's not much. It's 0.03% of the fresh water in the world is in the atmosphere. So why are people scared about melting of Greenland and Antarctica? Because if those two ice sheets melt, that's how much the sea would rise. And of course, there are all sorts of scenarios people put up with what's going to happen. For instance, here's one for North America. I'm not sure what this one is supposed to represent, how much of a sea level rise. But I live in Florida, and Florida is kind of flat and also low-lying. In fact, Florida is the answer to the following trivia questions. What U.S. state has the lowest, highest point? And then to remind you of your calculus days, when checking for a maximum, you always have to not only look at where the derivative is zero, but you'll have to look at the boundary. But the only state you have to do that is Florida, because the maximum occurs at the boundary. But naturally, I live in Florida. I'm pretty concerned about sea level rise. Just to show you, this is the highest point in Florida, the view from the highest point in Florida. And this is a road leading to the highest interior point in Florida. This one's called Sugarloaf Mountain up there. for those of you who have lived in places like Colorado, this is a joke. But anyway, here's what happens to Florida. 5 meter sea level rise is dark blue. 10 meter sea level rise is light blue. Now, fortunately, I don't live in this part of Florida. I live up there near Tallahassee. So things are not so bad there. This is a 6 meter sea level rise. And just think you're going to escape completely here in Britain. Here's what 6 meters will do to the area surrounding the North Sea. Now, like I said before, I live in North Florida. And this is what happens with a 60-meter sea level rise. And I just happen to live right about, where am I? Right about here. So with 60 meters, I might have beachfront property. So I'm not sure I'm that much against global warming. Okay. So why is science important? So there's this IPCC panel that every 7 years puts out a report. In fact, they're the ones who shared the Nobel Prize for Peace in 2007 with our politician Al Gore, who, by the way, lives in a 9,000 square foot house and flies from place to place in his own private jet. So his carbon footprint is not that small. He excuses that by saying that his 9,000 square foot house is very energy efficient. But anyway, that's just an aside. There's a lot of hypocrisy in this field on both sides of the arguments. So this panel puts out a report, and in 2007, their last report, they declared they're not willing to make predictions of sea level rise, although they had lots of graphs about it. They weren't ready to draw any conclusion, and they simply said the science is not credible. So there's, before that, and especially since then, there's lots more activity on ice sheets than there was before this report, and it's been ever increasing. And this is lots at an absolute scale. It's still, I think, relatively small compared to atmosphere and ocean research activity. So I'm going to go through the basics of ice sheet modeling. What are the models that people use, the mathematical models people use? And then I'll say a little bit about computations. So an ice sheet is, well, it's going to be the vertical direction. The bottom surface of the ice sheet, at least most of it, is abuts up to some bedrock. And the ice sheet is so heavy, for instance, in Greenland, that over the centuries it's actually made a significant indentation in the bedrock. And you know, in the middle of Greenland, there's basically a crater there just from the weight of the ice. H is going to be the ice elevation, so the thickness of the ice is H minus B. And the bottom could either be the bedrock or it can be an ice ocean interface. For instance, you have an ice shelf sticking out from land, then of course it interacts with the ocean. Ice sheets are modeled as very slowly moving incompressible, moving incompressible flow of a viscous fluid. So think of glaciers for slowness. To ward off Alzheimer's, I've heard that you should keep your mind active. I've been doing the New York Times crossword puzzle every day. And recently, they had a clue, epitome of slowness, and the answer was glaciers. So even the New York Times recognizes that. So think of incompressible Navier-Stokes as our flow model. But ice flows are not only slow, but their changes in ice sheet properties are slow even compared to changes in properties of the temperature in the ice sheets. So you neglect all the inertial terms. And so you have a quasi-static ice sheet model. Even though the problem is time-dependent, at each time step, you solve a time-independent equation for the dynamics. And the reason they're time-dependent is because the velocity and pressure are coupled to a time-dependent energy equation for you can think of as governing the temperature, and also a time-dependent equation for the height of the field. So for the dynamics.
You meant to neglect the U dot drive U up there, right? Not something is not obvious.
I meant to neglect the U dot grad U, yeah. It's not just, it's just eliminate all terms that have to do with inertia. So you get so you end up with the steady Stokes equations to solve. Now the footnote says this was, I really love this because I've done a lot of work on steady Stokes equation. Some of the books that that John alluded to are full of that business. Unfortunately, little did I know that it's not so easy because there's a highly nonlinear rheology involved. The viscosity depends very nonlinearly on the velocity, and the viscosity also depends on the temperature, also in a nonlinear manner. So like the evolution, as I said, the momentum equation is coupled to the temperature equation and to the ice thickness equation. Now the Stokes model is generally considered the gold standard for ice sheet modeling. I'm not sure that description is really justified. There may be a better standard, but that's, if you solve the Stokes model, people will believe what you're doing. You may not believe what you're doing, but others will. However, in the past, it was not used in climate models because it's hard to solve and expensive to solve. So instead, there are simplifications of the Stokes model, which mathematically can be derived by taking advantage of a small parameter appearing in the problem. Even though ice sheets like Antarctica and Greenland are thick, thousands of meters thick in places, they're very small compared to the horizontal extent of these ice sheets. So we have a small parameter, which is the basically vertical extent over the horizontal extent. And if you do your expansions with respect to that, and depending what terms you keep and what terms you throw out, you get different simplified models. And it's not really a hierarchy of model. It's more like a tree, as I'll point out in a minute. But compared to airline frequent flyer programs, there's more, in addition to gold, there are more membership levels here. So the gold is Stokes. Then there's so-called first order model. And first order does not refer to the accuracy, but refers to which terms you keep. And so if you keep the order delta terms, you get the first order model. If you threw out a few more terms, but still, you still get an order delta model that it's called the L1, L2 model. And then if you only keep order one terms, depending again what other assumptions you make, you don't just throw out the order delta terms here. You throw out some of the order one terms, without, you think they're not really order one, but they don't come out. So you got this at least five models around for ice sheets. And by far, the most used models in current climate system models are the ones down here. And only now are people thinking of adopting first-order models, Stokes models, and things like that. So what's a Stokes ice sheet model? Well, there in the first green box are the Stokes equations. And now you have to relate the viscous stress tau to the rate of strain tensor epsilon, which depends on the velocity. And the proportionality constant is a viscosity coefficient, eta. And there it is. And here's the nonlinear rheology, because this quantity here depends on the Frobenius norm, or this kind of the rate of strain tensor, and the A depends on the temperature. This is one type assumption, an Arrhenius type dependence. So that's where the trouble comes in. The usual value for N is 3. So you see that in that case, this exponent here is negative, so that you immediately say, well, I'm into trouble because I have 1 over something that could be 0 in places. And what does that mean? And turns out that's all right, because this is going to get multiplied by this thing here, which cancels out the 0 here. And although from a computational point of view, it's a pain in the neck. So there's an energy equation, which is a standard energy equation. And then there's a thickness evolution equation, which is also a standard hyperbolic equation for the thickness of the ice. Okay. So everything's pretty good here, except for this nonlinear rheology, but things get worse. Nonlinear rheologies people have dealt with, for instance, in mantle convection problems and things like that, quite successfully. Stokes problems with nonlinear rheology people have dealt with. Initial conditions. Well, you're given an initial domain, which may grow or shrink, depending on whether ice is accumulating or melting. And then you have initial condition for the temperature. And since we assume the quasi-static approximation, given the initial domain and the initial temperature, you can solve the Stokes equations to get the initial temperature, initial velocity. Now, my yellow boxes are going to be places that need some work. We don't know the initial temperature throughout Greenland or throughout Antarctica. We know it maybe through some surface measurements, some borehole measurements, maybe some satellite measurements, and that's it. Certainly in the interior, we know it almost nowhere. So the current gold standard for determining the initial temperature is to you construct the temperature field by vertically interpolating between the temperature on the bottom, which you're guessing at because you don't really know that except, again, some small places, and the surface temperature, which you do know pretty well. You interpolate between them to get a linearly, to get a initial field, and then you run your simulation code, your whole code, coupled code, until the temperature reaches a steady state because you put steady inputs, and that's the initial temperature you use. I'll come back to this point later, whether that's good enough or not. And then there's boundary conditions for the velocity and pressure. There's boundary conditions at the atmosphere and ice boundary, so that's some continuity of stress, same as the ocean ice boundary, some continuity of stress. And then we get to the bedrock. That's between the rock and the hard place, sort of. No penetration, that's easy one. Water doesn't penetrate, or ice doesn't penetrate the rock. And then there is some kind of condition that says that the tangential stress vector can be zero or can be non-zero, depending on whether the tangential stress is less than some threshold value or bigger than some threshold value. And that something, when it's non-zero, is a function of the tangential stress, tangential velocity times the velocity vector itself. Tangential velocity vector itself. Okay, what's beta? What's phi? What's tau c? Well, there are several choices around for phi. The one is to put phi equals 1. So that says tau t, which is, remember, tau t involves grad u plus grad u transpose dot n. So it's like a normal derivative type thing equals, and as you're looking at its tangential component, equals to something proportional to the velocity itself. So it's a Robin-type boundary condition. You can view it that way. So the great majority of the work is done for that boundary condition. And everybody knows it's not right. But still, that's the way things are. People think more correct is a Coulomb-type condition. So you divide ut by the magnitude of ut there. And then there are more complicated ones. A power law, which could be negative. This managed exponent, this number s there, turns out to be important because not only the physics, but the mathematics of ice sheets tell you there are limits to what s can be, depending on several situations. And then there's modified fixture. Anyway, there's four different things that people have thought of. Now, tau c is usually chosen to be a constant, or at least some function of x and y. But again, it should be proportional to, it should be a function of the normal stress. So whether something, so what that boundary condition is telling you is when something slides, and when the ice slides over the bedrock, and when the ice is fixed to the bedrock, depending which side of the threshold you're on. And so whether it slides or doesn't slide should depend on the normal stress, how much, you know, how much the ice weighs in a certain respect. So the one thing to do it is just make it proportional to the norm, or to the magnitude of the normal stress. So you notice there's several things in yellow there. So this needs work. Here's lots of things in yellow. Boundary condition for the temperature. Well, usually it's taken to be the mean annual surface temperature. And that's not so bad, because time steps here are not seconds or minutes. Things are going very slowly. Time steps are, you can take lots of time steps of your temperature solver for every time step you take of your Stokes solver, or, you know, to do a Stokes solve, because things aren't moving that fast. But maybe it's not the temperature you should be specifying. Same with the ocean boundary. And of course, the hardest one is, what do you do at the bedrock boundary, where you usually have a Neumann-type condition where you have two heat sources, a geothermal heat source. There are stuff coming out from the ground. And then there's also this, if it's sliding, there's heat due to friction of that sliding. Or what's usually done is make some wild guess for T at the bottom, and, you know, just put it down there, some value T. So that's why the temperature boundary condition at the bedrock needs work. By the way, I should have said that usually people don't say bedrock boundary condition, they say basal boundary condition. So if you hear me say basal boundary condition, I'm referring to the bottom of the ice sheet. Okay, and there's a condition on the height that if you make sea level your place at which the top of the ice is the top of the ice is zero, then you have a condition of the triple point. Now, I'm not going to talk about the mathematics of ice sheets too much, but we've done that. We've shown that the Stokes model has a solution, and that it's unique in appropriate function spaces. That's where that S comes from before, the appropriate function space. Has been proved for the Stokes ice sheet model for all choices of phi, and for the choices of tau c that I gave there. This is joint work with Qingxiang Shen and Mauro Perego. So there is mathematics behind this, but I'm not going to get into that here. I'll be very happy to talk to anyone about it, about that. Okay, what's the first simplified model? Well, the scaling analysis that I referred to, using that small parameter delta, is tantamount to assuming that horizontal derivatives of the vertical velocity are negligible, and that the vertical momentum balance is independent of x and y. In other words, that you can throw out the x and y derivatives of the stress in the divergence of the stress in the vertical momentum equation, and just keep the z derivative in there. So these can come out of mathematical expansions, or it can also come out from heuristic arguments by people who are very knowledgeable about ice. So either way, you get the first order model. So what do you get? So you get this model here. The details are not important. The important thing is that, the pressure has disappeared. And you only have two equations. And all of these stress variables here only involve the velocity. Because even if they don't involve the velocity in general, you've made some assumptions that tell you that they disappear, because these derivatives of w of the vertical velocity have disappeared. So these equations only involve the horizontal velocity components u and v. So that's the big simplification. The other, and an even perhaps more important simplification, you still have non-linear rheology here, which depend on the temperature and the and of course your domain in which you solve, this is still a 3D equation, there's still x, y, and z derivatives, and it depends on the height. But they uncouple from the, you can solve this given a temperature and given a, you can solve this in an uncoupled manner from the temperature and from the vertical momentum equation. So the constitutive relation, which depends on, also simplifies using the scaling analysis to only involve the two components of the velocity. So indeed, you reduce things. Once you've found U and V, W can be found by vertically integrating the continuity equation, and the pressure can be found by vertically integrating the simplified momentum equation. So those are just doing an ODE at each point on your grid. No PDE is involved, just multiple ODEs. The other equations, including the boundary conditions, also simplify. You have to make some assumptions that basically the bottom of the ice sheet is, the bottom and top of the ice sheet are very flat, so that the normal is practically in the vertical direction. So this is a 3D model, but it has significant advantage over Stokes. The costly part of the computation, the PDE solve that you have to do, has two unknowns instead of four now. Instead of U, V, W, P, you just have U and V. The continuity equation uncouples, so that you don't have to worry about numerical stability arising from bad choices for your discretization scheme, like not staggered grids if you use finite differences, or things that don't satisfy in soup conditions and finite elements. You just do it by standard discretization approaches. In fact, these horizontal momentum equations are nonlinear symmetric positive definite system of two second-order elliptic equations. And except for the nonlinearity, this is one of the holy grails of computing. You can solve Poisson's equation, even if you have to solve two Poisson's equations, you know, you're home free. So for instance, standard filament techniques can be used. So it's a great simplification, especially from the computational point of view. Next, shallow shelf model. This is a zeroth order model. So in addition to whatever led to the first order model, we assume hydrostatic balance, and we assume that certain components, additional components of the strain tensor are small. And then you get an even simpler set of equations. First of all, they're 2D. No Z derivatives, no Z, just X and Y. And the nonlinear rheology also only depends on X and Y. So this is a 2D model. So that's a fantastic simplification. The Bessel boundary condition, if it has this form, then you can actually integrate the shallow shelf equations on the previous slide to get an even simpler set of equations of this nature. And this is what's usually called the shallow shelf model. So the important thing is that this is a 2D model for U and V. Again, this is a first order. This is just like the first order model. It's a nonlinear system of symmetric, positive, definite elliptic equations. They're simpler because now not only you have two unknowns, but you're working in 2D instead of 3D. The shallow ice model is also a simplification of the first order model, but it makes different assumptions. In particular, just compare the assumptions here to the assumptions here. So here's the cross terms in the rate of strain tensor are neglected, and here different cross terms and some other diagonal terms are neglected. And this is really simple. This is what you get. Again, you get a 2D problem. Now you get a 3D problem, but very simple equations. And in fact, these equations can be integrated exactly. You can get a closed-form solution. This is great for computations because you don't have to do any computations. You just have to evaluate a formula. So this makes shallow ice. Shallow ice does not play the same role with thick ice as shallow water plays with thick water. So don't get, I was confused by that for a long time. I thought, oh, shallow ice is the same as shallow water. But it's not. It's a very different approximation. It'd be nice if you could solve shallow water explicitly and not have to solve it. None of us would be here this week, I guess. But you can't. Now, enough about models. There's something called the L1, L2 model that has recently gotten a lot of attention. It's kind of complicated to describe. I'll be happy to do so, but I think you had enough about models. I'll just say a few words. It's a third simplification of the first order model, which nominally has the same accuracy with respect to expansion parameter, although I'm not sure that's been shown. And it's derived through a vertical integration of the first order model. Vertically integrate. Remember, the first order model is a 3D model, but you vertically integrate it, and you get differential equations for the horizontal components of the velocity for the u and v along the bedrock boundary. So you basically had an equation that holds at the bottom of the ice sheet for the velocities there. So you have to assume the velocity, the bedrock boundary is not fixed everywhere, because in that case, there's nothing to solve for. So this model is really good for sliding regions, regions that are sliding. And once those equations are solved, the velocity components in the interior are determined by vertical integration. So that's the L1, L2 model. So here is it's not really a hierarchy, it's a tree. You start with Stokes. You derive first order. And for the first order, you can derive three other models. And here are the... what happened to the rest of this slide?
Okay. Something else down here. Next one. Hello. So what about the computation methodology
that we use? Well, first a few words about computational methodology. Most, under 20-some-odd climate system models in the world, most ice sheet models are done using shallow ice or things like that, at most first order model. They're done using uniform grids, which of course on the ice. And what we and almost everyone else in ice sheet modeling these days, they are now trying to use variable resolution grids, just like even a much larger percentage of people who are interested in building new methods for ice sheets they're all doing variable resolution grids. What are the grids we use? Well, not surprisingly, we use CVT grids. And in particular, we do a 2D CVT grid in the horizontal direction, and then we stack prismatic elements. In other words, there's a triangle, which could be at the top. And then we just stack prisms down. And then we divide each prism into tetrahedra. And I was told today that this is not a good idea for ocean modeling, but it's a perfectly good idea for ice sheet modeling, because you're solving elliptic equations. So there's nothing bad about that. And we like tetrahedra. So how do you do refinement? Well, you have two goals for refinement. At least I have two goals for refinement. It's to accurately resolve the boundaries of the ice sheet, and also to refine regions of interest. For the second goal, we're currently using proxies, such as ice sheet thickness, just to show we can do it. Of course, the real goal is to do some kind of goal-oriented active grid refinement, so that you really refine where you need it and not just where the ice is thin, although that's very likely you're going to need refinement there. So here's a CVT grid. You can see how good it is. Now, you may not be able to see whether it's any good by looking at this, but here's a blow-up of here. So this grid refinement is done to resolve the boundary accurately, and over here there's grid refinement to resolve stuff that's going on in the interior. Here's our 3D prismatic grid. This is blown up a huge amount compared to So you can see something, but you can't actually see anything. Here's another view of that. This is only blown up 15 times, the vertical direction. So really, the ice is a lot longer than it is thick. Okay. Discretization. Well, like I said, finite difference method on uniform grids are popular in old models. There are people now, several, who are doing finite volume-based approaches, including some having variable resolution. And there are quite a few groups. By the way, ice sheet modeling, I should have mentioned, has become a pretty good industry. I know of groups at MIT, South Carolina, Sandia, Los Alamos, I could name four or five other places just in the US, Fairbanks, Alaska. JPL has a very good group. I don't know why the Jet Propulsion Laboratory is interested in ice sheets, but they have a very good group putting out some very nice work on ice sheets. So anyway, it's a big industry now. So we and several others use filing methods along with very reasonable resolution grid. This is an elliptic equation. This, for Stokes modeling, we use Taylor-Hood, continuous quadratic velocities, continuous linear pressures. One of the criticisms against this particular element is it does a lousy job at making DVU equal zero, even for fluid problems, at least in some situations. And that we actually monitored this and found that indeed that's true. So we use an enriched Taylor-Hood where we add a discontinuous pressure to each element. Now this adds a lot of degrees of freedom, one per simplex, one per triangle, or one per tetrahedra. So you really only want to do this where you need to, and it turns out you don't need to do it a lot. So here is a straight Taylor-Hood with no modification of a glacier. This is a cross-section of a glacier, vertical direction, again, stretched a lot. And DVU can be as high as 1.86 in some of this colored region here. So it's pretty bad, and I'll tell you why. And then if you use our modified, not R, but this is well-known modification of Taylor-Hood, the maximum divergence is 10 to the minus 6, and we can actually make that smaller. The reason it's bad there is because this happens to be a place where the boundary condition along the bottom is switching from no slip to slip, and that messes you up. And that's actually a mathematical singularity and a physical pain in the neck, a physical reality and a computational pain in the neck. For the elliptic, real elliptic, second-order elliptic problems, we use quadratic elements. We've shown that if you use linear elements, you get much worse answers for the same cost. So quadratic elements are good. We've also shown that if you use cubic elements, you don't do much better for the same cost. So, and this is, of course, almost the universal rule of thumb in phi elements. Do quadratics, but not cubics. If you're really willing to leave linears, quadratics will buy you something, but cubics don't, for ordinary phi elements for elliptic equations. So we've developed the energy equation in current models that are implemented are often implemented by neglect. Again, just reducing them down to a one-dimensional equation in the vertical direction, again, by doing just like it happened for the velocity, and then just integrated that. We've developed a full phi element solver for the 3D equation, which is coupled to the Stokes. And likewise, okay, what's the next ingredient? Well, those people who do phi elements of finite volumes for Stokes or for the first order model usually use Picard. So most of us doing this business now implement the Newton's method. And this is relatively low-hanging fruit for speeding up simulations. On the other hand, Picard is robust, so we and others have found do a few, like in many situations, you do free iterations of Picard before you switch to Newton, and this is a difference in Picard and Newton for the first order and the L1 model. And here is Newton versus Picard for Stokes for four benchmark problems. So you buy something. So you can see at the beginning, at the beginning, you're basically doing Picard, and then you switch to Newton and zoom down. Linear solvers and parallelization. Well, we parallelize, of course, using METIS. Use solvers from trilinears for Boomer MG preconditioner, which didn't used to be in trilinears, but I think now is. We tried many preconditioners and found that to work the best. And so here's mesh partitioning for load balancing. We've gone, and here's scalability results. Looks great until you get to about 10,000 processors, and we want to go way beyond that. So there's work to be done. It becomes sort of lots of communications there. So we've also come up with an exact solution to the 3D Stokes problem with a minimal amount of... Anybody can come up with an exact solution if they're willing to put a right-hand side on every single PDE and every single boundary condition. Just pick U equals 7x squared, plug it in and see what the right-hand sides are. But we found an exact solution with what we consider minimal amount of disturbance to the data in the problem. And so this is good for verification. And so this is our verification of convergence rates. It should be 3. It should be 2. Close enough. It's nonlinear. And I don't think we're doing the Feilman error analysis. I don't think you're going to get 3 out of the analysis because of the nonlinearity. You're going to lose something. So this may be, these may be optimal. What's left to do? Well, lots. Lots of things have to be treated that have important effects. Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending with what you do for a living, and I'm hoping that those of you who are tired of ocean and atmospheres after many years will decide that this is an exciting area to work in because we need more smart people in this area. So there are major modeling issues to be resolved. There's still lots of improvement in the numerics, especially with regards to efficiency. For instance, get a really scalable implementation of what we're doing. And several opportunities for analysis and numerical analysis. Lots of, like, in fact, opportunities for math analysis and for numerical analysis if you're interested in proving theorems, as I am. I'm just going to touch on 3 pressing issues. Not surprising, the Bessel boundary condition is probably at the top of the list. Because how the ice interacts with the bedrock probably is as unimportant or more important than anything else that happens to the ice. Because ice sliding can really accelerate melting. The heat that is produced by friction as the ice slides can really heat up the ice big time. But lots is unknown about how to model interaction. Those functional forms of the boundary conditions I gave you are good guesses by smart people. The values of the parameters that appear in those functional forms are also, guesses based on some information, but maybe not completely informed. So, can these questions be answered by solving inverse problems? So, what sort of data is available to guide an inverse design of these boundary conditions? And I'm not just talking about identifying parameters. We're in the midst of doing that. I want to also identify functional form in some sense. And is that data good enough to arrive at rational answers? The data is very sparse, as I said before, about all of this. So are you going to get... Sure, you can do an inverse design problem and get the best possible solution you can, the best possible design, based on the data available to you. But if you have bad data or not enough data, it may not be a very good design in the end. It's the right answer to not a good problem. And maybe existing inverse design algorithms can inform where field people who go out and do field measurements place their sensors, etc., to get, in other words, an optimal placement of sensors so that you get the data you need at the cheapest cost. Of course, I'm interested in this because I'd like to go spend not too long, but spend a little while at Greenland and Antarctica and go help them put out sensors for a day or two in the middle of summer, of course. So Bayesian boundary conditions are wide open for modeling, wide open even for numerics, and to a certain extent for mathematical analysis as well. I mentioned the initial temperature. So I mentioned how the initial temperature is found these days by interpolating between the top and bottom and then marching to a steady state. And I'm not sure anyone thinks that's a reasonable thing because you already know the data. So again, we have a data simulation problem here. You have sparse data. You want a temperature at every grid point. You only know the temperature at a few points in your domain, maybe lots of few points. But the data, maybe you may have good data in time. These sensors can measure the temperature almost continuously. So this is exactly like the data simulation problem for weather prediction. Try to identify the weather today, even though you only have weather stations every 30 kilometers. How do you fill in the grid? You do data simulation. And so the same sort of idea may apply here. And again, the same questions arises for the Bayesian boundary condition. Is the data good enough to get a credible initial result for the temperature? Now, the last thing I'm going to mention, I didn't talk at all about. And that's because it's sort of swept under the rug. And that's moulins and crevices. Moulin is in Moulin Rouge. So what's a moulin? Here's a picture of a moulin. You get some sort of ice lake or ice river, stuff flowing into it. And for some reasons that are not completely understood, all of a sudden, this thing just penetrates down to the bottom. Same as ice going into a crevice, pressed down to the bottom. And you see what happens. Here's a picture of a moulin. These people are brave, I think. What happens is then the water, this is relatively warm water compared to what's going on down there. This water then just penetrates along the bottom of the ice, along the bedrock, eventually comes out of the bottom of the bedrock and greatly accelerates the movement of ice.
Just to be clear, in that picture, that's a river of water. That's liquid.
Yes. That's one of these things right here. It's liquid water, yeah. Liquid water. Yes,
they're brave.
Yeah, they're very brave. Because this goes down to the bottom. So clearly these moulins and crevices have a really important effect. Because if you get water down there, it changes it changes the ball game 100%. Modeling water down here is not hard. We're trying to do that now ourselves. Modeling how the water gets down there is impossible because even though this thing looks big, on the scale, you don't know where they're going to happen. And even if you know where they're going to happen, they're a subgrid in size. So we haven't really started this, but we're thinking about how to maybe model this stochastically somehow by some stochastic things. But again, this is wide open. No one really knows how to do this, or I don't know. I don't think ice sheet models out there have moulins or crevices built in. This is one of the reasons they don't produce credible science even to this day.
Is there a change of phase then, the moulins?
No, it's melting. It's change of phase in the sense that it's melting. Ice melts on the top of, especially in the summer, on the top of Greenland and Antarctica all the time. And sometimes it does that. Sometimes it just melts and then refreezes later on, and sometimes it creates a moulin. And then there are also crevices formed. The ice is moving. There's friction at the bottom, so cracks form. And, then water can just run down there like a waterfall, yeah.
But why does this tiny amount of water in the moulin not refreeze as it penetrates?
Because it's hot enough.
It's hot enough at the surface. Okay.
It's hot enough to penetrate all the way down. Ice at the bottom is not really that cold. It's not really, I think it's like minus 37 or something. It's not really super cold. I can give you a small sample of computational results. The time is getting late. So here's what happens if you have no slip and you allow for slip at the bottom. You get a completely different answer. Here's a comparison between Stokes and first order with a no-slip boundary condition, and with a slip boundary condition, they're more significant here. Here's a comparison between the lower order models. Shallow shelf is no good because it's good for sliding, and most of Greenland is not sliding. Same with Antarctica. So we're currently preparing lots of other things, a paper which will do careful comparisons of the different models. And now, so what is my last slide? It tells you what's really predicted as of today in ice sheet modeling. So here are the predictions for sea level rise due to Greenland melting. So these are the envelopes of the different models. This is the ensemble mean, and this is a particular calculation done by the community ice sheet model, developed at Los Alamos with lots of collaborators, the one that I'm most closely related to. And green, and this is a latest run with CSISM after some improvements over this one, and this is a run with MPAS, which is basically our model, our first order model, using our first order model. I didn't tell you what the axis here is. That's millimeters. So I don't think I'll get beachfront property because this is over 100 years. The worst prediction is 165 millimeters for the amount of sea rise due to Greenland. Of course, Antarctica will contribute, you know, several much more, but it's not going to be the order of 60 meters. Probably won't be the order of 6 meters. But still, it's something. The Maldives will be underwater if it's 2 meters. So some people should worry. But still, that's where it is. But this is still not science-based, in my opinion. All those unanswered questions that have to, and even a necessary condition for it to be science, it may not be sufficient to answer all the questions I've posed. And even then, who knows? But certainly even the 2014 report by the IPCC, it's closed now, what you can put in. Closed a couple of months ago. In other words, whatever was the best results of a couple of months ago are going to be in that report. Because people are now going to have to test against each other and all that. And so very, very little, almost nothing about what I talked about is going to be in the next report either. So the science in the next report is going to be better than in the last report, but it's not going to be the latest yet because we weren't ready for prime time and neither were any of the other people who are trying to do similar things that we were. So I guess I'll get another Nobel Prize at that time. Okay, well, thank you for your attention and I'll be happy to answer questions.
Max has offered to answer questions. Are there any questions on this very nice talk?
Do your prediction take into account when ice sheets are breaking and melting in spectacular ways?
I should have mentioned calving, which is big pieces going off. No, they don't, and they should, but calving is not a huge contributor compared to melting. I mean, in the summer especially, they're just rivers of ice. Like one of my first cartoons had this spigot, this faucet, you know, with water coming out. That was trying to emulate the fact that there's these rivers of ice just pouring water into it. So calving is not negligible, but it's nowhere near as important as getting the melting right.
You mentioned at the beginning you have existence and uniqueness results on these equations.
Yes.
And then you explained to us, I don't know whether these were the same equations, but you explained to us you look at nonlinear rheology and in particular temperature-dependent viscosity, etc. Is the melting and basically the viscosity vanishing totally or what?
No, our theorems are not coupled to temperature.
Okay.
Temperature is assumed. So they're just for the dynamic.
Right.
Just for the dynamics.
So basically your viscosity stays away from zero.
No, not necessarily, because okay. The gradient of the velocity could be zero at places. No, it doesn't stay away from zero.
Wait a second, when the gradient of velocity is zero, then
it's one over the gradient of the velocity squared raised to a power.
I see.
Is basically the nonlinear reality. One over the strain rate raised, the magnitude of the strain rate raised to a power, yeah. So I mean this appears in many other in other applications, yeah.
There's a question at the back, and then the chap in the white shirt, and then the lady with the glasses. Yeah.
Do you have a sense, either from your modeling or from other inputs, whether the temperature field is dominated more by geothermal heating or from viscous dissipation?
Yeah, that's, I don't. Others may.
I think in the latter case, your initial conditions on temperature are not so important. In the latter case, if the heat is mostly being generated internally by viscous heating,
no,
perhaps your initial conditions are not so important.
That's true. But I think the most important heat generation is probably due to friction at the bottom.
The base of the heating.
Yeah. And so, the initial conditions, there's a point there, yeah. Who's next?
Okay. White shirt.
I was wondering if there's any relation to models of crust deformation in the Earth mantle, because it kind of came to my mind that if you have these slide non-slide boundary conditions, that is quite similar to when you have two kind of
not only is the boundary condition similar, but also also the PDEs are similar. Mantle convection is also nonlinear Stokes, where they, although they actually solve the time dependent version with time steps of 100,000 years, they have a nonlinear rheology. Yeah, there's a lot of similarity between the two. Yeah, although I think the boundary conditions that they look at are different somehow.
That's true.
But there's a lot of similarities, absolutely. Mathematically, even more so.
At the back, yes.
I have a question about the mullings, the water in the ice. I was wondering, because the water is inside the ice, right? That is such a thing as we can't lift myself by my arms. So I think the difference between there's the liquid in the ice and without it, just the bottom condition, like the friction is different.
No, it's melting. That's why it goes out, because it melts the ice.
But can we view this as a hole, and this water is just inside the ice?
Yes.
So the force is, that they can't make it move because it's inside. Right.
It can melt stuff.
It can melt.
No, it changes the friction at the bottom. That's
the
main point.
That's the change. So if there's just one difference between these two ice, so things become simpler, I think. The bottom condition is different, but there's no other force, right?
No.
So we can just fix the friction according to different conditions.
Yeah, but you don't know where that water is going to be. No, we do change the friction. In fact, that's why we have the sliding ability at the bottom. So we do change it, but we have to know where it's fixed and where it isn't.
Question here in the middle. Hi. Then Iria after that. Go ahead. No, you at the front. Yeah.
Just a question about ice shelves. You do include ice shelves in the model, I assume, and basal melting of them. So
yes,
with the predictions for. End of this century.
Several of the models have ice shelves. That's why I had an ocean ice shelf. That's why I had an ocean, ice boundary condition. That's to model ice shelves, yeah.
Right.
So that's included.
For the ocean, then, are you using existing ocean temperatures or?
Well, we actually use a continuity of the, stress. So we use the pressure. Oh, for the temperature equation, we use an ocean ocean temperature, yeah.
Which consequences stays the same over the next century, I guess, in the models, I guess.
Yeah, well, they're supposed to be coupling, right? They're supposed to be two-way coupling, but yeah, I think most of them just keep it constant. By the way, one thing that people have noticed is that there is a significant difference in results from standalone ice sheet models and when you put them inside a climate system model and couple it to everything else. In other words, the guesses you made for what the data is when you extracted it out and made it stand alone are not very good because you get very different answers. Quite different, yeah.
Right. There's a question about your finite element implementation. You said quadratic elements are good, cubic elements don't work, and presumably because of low regularity of the solution. Now, I'm almost willing to bet money that the solution is irregular but not uniformly. Because low regularity is probably implied by local features.
It's true.
Why not something like HP adaptivity?
Yeah, well, sure, that would be great. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, like I said, there's plenty of numerics to do too. Yeah, HP would work very nicely. Yeah, you're right, these are singularities are localized. Well, the boundary is extremely rough, but, that doesn't really contribute to bad singularities. You can deal with that with grid refinement, but real mathematical singularities, yeah, they're very isolated. I think you had a question?
I can ask.
Okay.
On that note of accord, I think we should thank Max once again for maintaining the high standard of the Rothschild lecture.